light meal will be provided. Central Lakes College Performing Arts Center presents a free staged reading of The Pillow Man, a dramatic play, Friday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. in the Dryden Theater on the Brainerd campus. Intended for audiences 18+. Tickets are free, but should be reserved at clcperformingarts.com. The next Bemidji Contra Dance is Saturday, January 24th at 6:30 at Lammers Town Hall in Solway. All ages and abilities may dance to live acoustic music by 4 Mile Portage. Everything will be taught, and the first hour is dedicated to young families. The Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Quota Permit will be available beginning at 9 a.m. Wednesday, January 28th for the 2026 season. Book reservations online at recreation.gov, BWCAW, or call 877-444-6777. Visitors are encouraged to review the trip planning guide and do your homework for the more than 265 backcountry campsites. Now back to Morning Edition.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump has just arrived in Switzerland to attend the World Economic Forum. He's expected to face more questions about his demands for Greenland. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney spoke yesterday, calling the political situation a, quote, rupture. He says middle powers, such as Canada, must now act together. He warns if they don't put themselves at the table, they'll find themselves on the menu.
But I'd also say that great powers can afford for now to go it alone. They have the market size, the military capacity, and the leverage to dictate terms. Middle powers do not. But when we only negotiate bilaterally with a hegemon, we negotiate from weakness. We accept what's offered. We compete with each other to be the most accommodating. This is not sovereignty. It's the performance of sovereignty while accepting subordination.
Carney based his speech on a famous essay by the late Czech dissident and president Václav Havel. The essay discusses dissent in the face of totalitarian rulers. The Trump administration says it has no plans to stop its immigration crackdown in Minnesota. The Justice Department is investigating top Democrats in the state who've criticized the operation. Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik reports.
Governor Tim Walz, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, and St. Paul Mayor Kali Herr all received subpoenas as part of an investigation into allegations of impeding federal law enforcement. Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino says the operation will continue. Despite documented instances of agents breaking into homes without warrants, he insists their tactics are constitutional.
Everything we do every day is legal, ethical, moral, well-grounded in law.
For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case that has worried financial markets. At issue is the independence of the Federal Reserve Board, the nation's central bank. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports the Fed sets interest rates.
President Trump, like other presidents before him, has tried to get the Fed to lower interest rates more quickly. Doing so would almost certainly help his party in this year's elections. But the Fed was established 112 years ago as an independent entity in order to insulate it from political pressure and to protect the country from rampant inflation that often results from lowering interest rates too quickly. Frustrated by the Fed's caution, Trump tried to fire board member Lisa Cook and clearly has the Fed chairman Jerome Powell in his sights, even though he picked Powell as the Fed chair in 2018. Today, the Supreme Court hears arguments as to whether the president has that power or whether the law protecting the Fed should remain intact. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are down 60 points. It's NPR. There's been a commuter train crash in Spain today that's killed one person. It comes after Sunday's collision between two trains that killed at least 42. Regional commuter trains in the Catalonian region have been suspended today. The body of famed Italian fashion designer Valentino is now lying in state in Rome. His funeral is Friday. He was beloved by stars and American first ladies. Hundreds are expected to attend Valentino's public viewing. Consumers online are becoming more curious and critical about polyester clothing. Some users question the effects it may have on the environment. NPR's Ayanna Archie has more.
Polyester in clothing is more common than in recent years. It's largely fueled by fast fashion consumers who want to be on trend and pay as little as possible. and the retailers that want to meet consumers' demands while keeping expenses low. But in some cases, polyester clothing doesn't hold up for long. As people toss them, abandoned clothing is ending up on coastlines in other countries, and they could stay there. Polyester isn't biodegradable.
We're kind of at the point of understanding just where the plastics are.
Aaron Stubbins, an environmental sciences professor at Northeastern University, says a lot more research is needed to draw conclusions about how polyester could be impacting our surroundings. Ayanna Archie, NPR News.
Vice President J.D. Vance and Second Lady Usha Vance have announced they're expecting a baby in July. This will be the Vance's fourth child. The vice president says that it will be a boy. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is Megan Buffington, reporter for KAXE's news team. I have a book of poetry published by the League of Minnesota Poets in 1944, and I want to share a few snippets with you. Here's part of The Mississippi by Clement Wood. Old Man River rises in Itasca, rises in 10,000 lakes, aiming for the sea. Cass, Winnebagoshish, gem-like Pokegama, flowing so the land's rain can at last be free. Old Man River, born in Minnesota, just beneath the Lake of the Woods, the land's northernmost reach, never forgets the state of his birth, never ceases dreaming of bright lakes and big woods, oak, maple, beech. Old Man River, as the gray skies open, rains into his lakes again, far from gulf and sea, and the glad land's voice whispers the soft message, only in the heart's home can we at last be free.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Mae Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump has been speaking about affordability for weeks and planned to focus on that in a speech today at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
But the summit is being overshadowed by the president's desire for Greenland and his threats of tariffs on eight European countries if he doesn't get his way. So when Trump takes the stage in Davos, world leaders will be listening closely for signs of where this confrontation with allies goes next.
NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has been following it all. We've known, Danielle, that Donald Trump sometimes weaves around in speeches. So what's on the agenda today?
Well, he said he's been planning to talk about the economy and specifically, as he put it, how well the United States is doing. And the White House had said that Trump would specifically address housing policy today. But it's nevertheless true that, like you say, everyone just wants to hear about Greenland at this point because Trump has been upending relations with many key allies over Greenland. And in the process, he's been threatening tariffs, complaining about not getting the Nobel Peace Prize, criticizing NATO, and posting screenshots of his texts with world leaders. Now, yesterday at a White House press briefing, Trump did strike a less combative tone on Greenland.
I think that we will work something out where NATO is going to be very happy and where we're going to be very happy. But we need it for security purposes.
But of course, this is Trump. We have no idea if that means any change in his attitude. But at any rate, he also mentioned he has a slew of meetings set up in Davos about Greenland.
Now, he spoke for what, more than 90 minutes yesterday. I mean, what ground did he cover there?
Well, he covered all the ground. He really rambled in those 90 minutes. Now, it was the one-year anniversary of Trump taking office again, and so he came out with this thick sheaf of papers, and he said it was a book of his accomplishments over the past year. But really, he just kept veering into this extended riff, parts of which we've heard many times before. He focused heavily on Minnesota. He criticized Minnesotans who are protesting ICE's presence in the wake of the deadly shooting. And he also, once again, railed against the state's Somali population, making this claim without evidence.
The Somalians vote as one group, even if they're not citizens, and they vote as one group, and you know, you get 600,000 votes against you. They all ought to get the hell out of here. They're bad for our country.
Now, he did also hype the U.S. economy, including making exaggerated claims about inflation and the impact of his tariffs, but he didn't really follow up on all of those plans he's proposed in recent weeks to help people with affordability. And there was stuff to talk about there. Just last night, the White House released an executive order aimed at preventing large institutional investors from buying homes. So policies were in the works. He just didn't really bring them up.
All right. So trying to put all of this together, everything we just mentioned, his press conference, the trip to Davos. I mean, what does all of this mean? Politically or practically, what's his aim?
Well, on foreign policy, he clearly enjoys being on the world stage and setting the agenda there. And crucially, without some of the guardrails he had in his first term, he's just doing what he wants on foreign policy. So he's pursuing that belligerent policy that's alienating allies. It's not popular domestically. But then when you take that with his aggressive tactics in Minnesota, it's all continually drawing attention, including his own, away from things like the domestic economy that he ostensibly wants to focus on.
That's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
As we heard there, President Trump is scheduled to speak at Davos today after European leaders and U.S. allies showed unity against his threats to take Greenland from European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who promised an unflinching response.
The point is that the world has changed permanently and we need to change with it.
To French President Emmanuel Macron.
It's as well a shift towards a world without rules, where international law is trampled underfoot, and where the only law that seems to matter is that of the strongest, and imperial ambitions are resurfacing.
And then there was Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, who carried a much starker message, that Canada and others could no longer pretend the old world order, a U.S.-led world order, was still functioning. He began his speech in French. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
Today I will talk about a rupture in the world order. The end of a pleasant fiction and the beginning of a harsh reality, where geopolitics, where the large main power geopolitics is submitted to no limits, no constraints.
He went on to say in English that middle powers like Canada could no longer afford to be part of this fiction that had provided public good, open sea lanes, a stable financial system, collective security.
More recently, great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons. Tariffs as leverage, financial infrastructure as coercion, supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited. You cannot live within the lie of mutual benefit through integration when integration becomes the source of your subordination.
Carney urged other middle powers to unite and find a way to rival great powers like the United States. Let's break this all down with veteran diplomat and president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Layla.
So those are pretty stark words from Carney, where he called this moment a rupture and not a transition. Were you surprised to hear Canada, such a close U.S. ally and neighbor, basically say we're out when it comes to the U.S.-led world order, we're done pretending, and we're actively seeking an alternative?
I think the Canadian foreign minister said what essentially the allies and the Europeans are all thinking, that even if somehow we can find a way to reach an accommodation over Greenland, big question mark, that this does represent something qualitatively different. We're not going back. This is not the United States they thought they knew. This is not the alliance partnership they had in mind. And essentially, this has been a wake-up call. And what you're seeing is a collective, statement, proclamation that we now have to find new arrangements to look after ourselves because we can no longer depend on the United States.
If the old world order is dead, which Carney essentially declared it dead, What is the new world order that he describes and that you see?
That's a bigger question. It's one thing to get out with the old. It's almost like regime change. You know, the conversation we've been having about Venezuela, Iran, all these countries. It's one thing to oust the former leadership, something very different to put in new arrangements that work. We're almost seeing the same thing going on at the international level. Hmm. We've had a set of arrangements that's worked for 8 decades. The United States played a leading role with our allies and partners. That seems to have essentially run its course, largely because the United States woke up one day under President Trump and said, we don't like this anymore. We don't want to do this anymore. So then the question is, what takes its place? What I think you heard from the Canadian Prime Minister is medium powers. Europe essentially is a bunch of medium-sized powers, not great powers. They have to find both new ways of cooperating with one another, maybe become a little bit stronger, a little bit more self-sufficiency, and maybe reach out to the Chinas and others and try to work out some kind of a understanding with them. Bottom line, though, they can't put all their eggs in America's basket.
Where does that leave the United States, though, if U.S. allies are actively seeking an alternative to rival U.S. power? Where does that leave the U.S.?
Leaves the United States with less influence. Economically, we're isolating ourselves because we've opted out of a lot of trading relationships through the unilateral use of tariffs. It's a fundamental change. We're isolating ourselves. Let me just make a larger point. Hmm. You know, for 80 years, we have essentially worked the world, and you've done pretty well, by the way. It hasn't been perfect, but I would argue it's been the greatest run in history in terms of peace and wealth and stability. People are living longer and living better, and we did it not through coercion. We didn't force people to work with us, but we made it attractive to work with us. We made it through consent. We basically said, you work with us, the deal will be good for us, but it will also be good for you. And that's coming to an end. We're basically now saying, you've got to do it our way or it's the highway. It's become coercive using tariffs or even the threat of military force. And I think the biggest difference is we are going to isolate ourselves. We are no longer going to have these partnerships we can leverage. We've thrown away, in some ways, the great structural advantage of American foreign policy, which is that we woke up every morning and we had a bunch of partners willing and able to work with us.
I mean, the U.S. has been involved in conflict in the last few decades, Iraq, mm-hmm. Afghanistan. I mean, I think the difference now is that this is very public confrontation with the allies that were typically U.S. partners. I wonder what type of reception you think that the president will receive today at Davos, given what we heard, not just from Prime Minister Carney, but also echoes of it in some of our European allies' comments as well.
Two things. One is, yes, we've had these conflicts, as you pointed out, in Iraq and Afghanistan, but these were side conflicts. These were not conflicts in the main venues of international relations, in Europe and in Asia. And what's happening with the war in Ukraine, potentially with China and Taiwan, is conflict is returning to the central theaters of the world, not to peripheral theaters. Mm-hmm. That would be something qualitatively different. What happens today, tremendous anticipation. People are going to be looking for any and every signal about Greenland. But I think, look, Trump has now made himself central, dominant, and I think you'll have those who will be very negative. We saw that in the reaction to the Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary at Davos. But mainly just curiosity. People want to see if there's a deal to be had on Greenland. And I think that's the central question. But let me make one point. Even if there is a deal on Greenland, mm-hmm. there's no going back to where we were. And I think that's the larger point, that we have done an awful lot of destruction. So even if we can somehow manage to avoid a conflict over Greenland, I don't think there's any going back to the old world. That's where I think the Prime Minister of Canada's speech might be even more important than the President's speech.
Veteran diplomat Richard Haass is President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you for being on.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and in just a bit, I'll be joined by Jen Kellen, and we'll be your host for the morning show until 9 o'clock before we hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Our listeners love supporting the businesses that support KAXE. If you're interested in connecting with KAXE listeners, call 218-326-1234 to learn about sponsorship opportunities. Big thanks goes out to all of our current business supporters. And KBXE presents Ski Palooza at Three Island Park in Bemidji this Saturday from noon to 3. Come cross-country ski, snowshoe, fat tire bike, play music, or just swap stories around the fire. Bring a snack to share. Brainerd Nordic Ski Club's Lumberjack Jaunt has been rescheduled to Sunday, February 1st at Northland Arboretum. Choose from skate or classic with distances of 6 or 16 kilometers. A free kids race is also offered. Find more info and register at BrainerdNordicSkiClub.com. Saxon Bog near Meadowlands offers a closer look at winter bird species with a series of programs Saturday, January 24th and Sunday, January 25th. Learn about finches, owls, woodpeckers, and chickadees. Find more details and register at saxzim.org/events. Now back to Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia. For 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. One of the most difficult decisions a performing artist can make is choosing when to step away. From mezzo-soprano Denise Graves, that time is now. After 45 years that have taken her to the world's most prestigious opera houses, she's taking her final bow on January 24th. It will be at the Metropolitan Opera in New York after her final turn as Mariah in Porgy and Bess. I caught up with Denise Graves backstage as she was running through her vocal warm-ups minutes before going on stage. Thank you so much for letting us come while you get yourself ready.
Yeah, look how That's beautiful.
Well, you know, I had to dress up for you.
That's right. Well. You are well put together. Beautiful. Thank you for doing this.
The next day, she joined me at NPR's New York studios to share how it all started for her.
I had just gotten accepted into this performing arts high school, and I was going to class, and I ran into this a friend of mine who said, I just heard something that you've got to hear. And so we went to the listening library, and she'd found a recording of Leontine Price singing Puccini arias. We cut all of our classes. We didn't eat anything. We didn't drink anything. We never went to the ladies' room. We stayed there all day.
Wow.
Listening to Leontine on a loop. And she and I declared after that moment that that's what we're going to do.
Wow.
I mean, first of all, I'd never heard many other types of genres of music, and certainly not opera. That was as foreign and as strange as anything could possibly be. But then to also see this woman who looked like us and heard this type of singing that just split you in half and changed me, changed my life.
I saw you perform, and your voice sounds sublime to me. To me.
Thank you.
So why now?
There are a number of things that are pointing me in this direction. I'm very fulfilled. I've done the things that I've wanted to do. I would say that I feel pulled really now in the direction of the work that my foundation is doing.
I also asked Graves about her decision to retire with Porgy and Bess, which was composed and written by white men and is filled with stereotypes of black life.
But nobody ain't gonna peddle no hoopy dust round my shop. Does ya hear what I say?
At the time, George Gershwin stipulated that the opera be performed by an all-black cast. In part, that was to avoid white performers in blackface. But it also created major opportunities for African-American singers.
Oh, my goodness. After COVID, the Metropolitan Opera opened up with Terrence Blanchard's Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And since then, we've seen Champion, we've seen Malcolm X, we've seen lots of wonderful stories that tell about the black experience. That's not Porgy and Bess. But I had been thinking that I was going to retire soon. When I was offered this role, it seemed like a perfect full circle because my very first professional contract was Porgy and Bess. That was in 1985.
Denise Graves has portrayed some of the most beloved heroines of opera, like Carmen and Delilah, around the world. She's won numerous honors and prizes, including the Marian Anderson Award. All this from someone who did not start out with a classical music background as a child.
I'm grateful that you think my story is important enough to go out on NPR. This makes me want to cry.
No. I'm grateful. I'm so grateful. You know, I think about people like my mother who doesn't have a story that you would find compelling enough to air to your audiences, but who has had an incredible life that should be told.
You're carrying her with you.
Oh, and not only her. My grandmother, those stories of African-American artists that we don't know about, you know, Elizabeth Taylor Greenfield, Ciceretta Jones, you know, I owe them a debt of gratitude and I have a responsibility for that. Those individuals who have shaped the industry.
As a native Washingtonian, Graves called the Kennedy Center one of her professional homes. In February, President Trump took over the performing arts venue that's a living memorial to one of his slain predecessors and named himself chairman. More recently, his hand-picked board added his name to the building.
Every day, I'm in conversations about, are we good to go forward?
In the days after we spoke, the Washington National Opera left the Kennedy Center, which it has called home for 55 years. Graves will now direct Scott Joplin's Treemonisha at George Washington University's Lisner Auditorium in March. So we followed up with Graves.
And of course, people are entitled to do as they feel. I know that this decision was not an easy one. But for people who have been reluctant or who have actually drawn a line, I'm hoping that this will re-engage people who enjoy, you know, really alive theater to come out and support this work. Music can be an agent for peace. I'm interested in that transformative power that can transcend everything. Race, socioeconomic status, language. And that's what I'm choosing to lean into.
As you retire from performance, what are your treats? What have you denied yourself that
pizza.
You are going to have? Pizza.
Pizza. Oh, my gosh. Cheese. Martinis.
That is mezzo-soprano Denise Graves. She is planning to retire from performance at the end of the current run of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess at the Metropolitan Opera on January 24th. Denise Graves, it has been a delight to speak with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The title of Gabriel Talent's new novel, Crux, refers to the most challenging section of rock climbing. Talent, a climber himself, embraces the fear that comes with the joy in the sport.
I love that climbing can have this inch by inch
terror.
I'm Elsa Chang. How that terror is less scary than teenage life on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle, and I'm joined by Jen Kellen.
Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. It is cold out.
It's a little chilly. But although, yeah, you were going to say just what I was going to say. 4 degrees feels warmer.
Well, that wasn't below. What I was going to say. Okay. I was going to say it was great not having to scrape my windows this morning because it's so cold.
Yeah. Did you get a little snow flurry in town? It was...
Yesterday there was, like, okay. snow.
It was a little snowy out at our house this morning.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't. Well, I did have to clear off my car, so maybe okay. it was just like a very light snow.
A little dusting.
But I was just happy I didn't have to scrape, because yesterday I had scraped the outside and inside of my windows, which is always fun.
Yeah. I turned my car on, turned the defrost on full yesterday, and even after several minutes, it was like I still had to scrape, so... Ugh. It was a hard frost. Very hard.
It's a brand new day.
That's behind us.
No frost today.
Is there snow on the forecast for today?
Do I remember seeing there is it? Snow likely going on until at least noon today. Otherwise, it should be cloudy with highs 13 to 19 degrees, which, folks, I'll be honest with you, enjoy it today while you can. Southwest winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, slight chance of snow. Lows around 14 to 18 below. West-northwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Thursday, partly sunny and cold. Temperature falling to negative 16 below to 22 below. Blustery northwest winds gusting up to 25 miles per hour. Evening lows around 30 below.
So, to be clear, the negative 16 to negative 22, that's happening during the day on Thursday.
Yes, by 5 o'clock it should be that.
Okay, and then we're going to go a little lower
yep.
for Thursday night.
And then Friday, our high is 12 below, so.
Oh.
So we're under an extreme cold watch in effect until January 25th at noon. The dangerously cold wind chills as low as 50 below could cause frostbite on exposed skin in as little as 5 minutes. So please be careful this week.
Time to dig out the long johns.
Yeah.
If you haven't already.
And scarves.
Yes.
Do you have a scarf? Are you a scarf person?
I have several scarves because I'm a knitter.
Oh, okay.
And I don't wear
them. Yeah, I was about to say, I don't think I've ever seen you wear one.
I should. I have a really nice scarf. Okay, you're reminding me to dig it out. I have a really nice scarf that's a really soft alpaca yarn. Uh-huh. But I tend to just wear like a buff, you know, like a...
Oh, yep.
It's faster, less bulky.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a scarf guy. I've never seen you in a scarf.
I do when I cross-country ski.
Oh, really? Yep. And not a buff? You go scarf?
No, I go scarf. I don't have a buff. I don't have buff money.
Because you spent it all on your hammer.
Yeah.
And your shovel.
I do have a cordless drill now.
Wow. Did you get it for Christmas?
Yeah, my dad had an extra one, so he gave it to me.
How's that feel?
Well, I haven't used it yet.
Oh, but just knowing you have one.
Yeah. Knowing I can fix...
Anything.
A lot of things. I wouldn't say anything, but...
You got YouTube, and you got a cordless drill.
Yeah, and I've got a dream.
That should be your biography.
So, we have got quite the show for you this morning. We're going to be joined by some Beltrami County Master Gardeners around 8:10 this morning. We're going to be talking about some events they've got going on in the next couple months, plus a new project they've got working on at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds. And then also later in the show, we'll have Area Voices, my conversation with Kent Estee about the Good Stories exhibit that is at the Watermark Art Center now. And they are going to have a reception for it on February 14th.
Wow, Valentine's Day.
Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, January 26th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The board's meeting schedule is at kaxe.org. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders are among those raising concerns about the stability of mental health and substance abuse services. That's after a temporary major cut in federal funding last week. Chuck Kornbach reports.
The White House announced roughly $2 billion in cuts to the SAMHSA, or Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. The government said the money no longer aligned with President Trump's public health agenda. Then, about 24 hours later, and without explanation, the grants were restored. The Ho-Chunk Nation is one of about 2,000 organizations that would have lost funding. Ho-Chunk President John Greender says last week's cuts, had they held, would have been on top of other reductions announced a year ago that were only partly restored.
Those never came back online completely, especially those who work close with the program.
Greender says the Indian Health Service has also lost staff nationwide. He says the uncertainty not only harms indigenous communities, which he calls America's most vulnerable populations.
It is dealing with the most vulnerable populations within a vulnerable population. We are working on mental health issues. We are working with addiction, domestic abuse, and all the, you know, social determinants of health.
Greender says overall the Ho-Chunk Nation is providing a good level of services, but only after greater partnering with the state of Wisconsin and some nearby counties. The question for some organizations is whether the Trump administration will try again sometime to make major cuts in federal dollars. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Indigenous students and families are concerned about rising costs as the U.S. Department of Education resumes wage garnishment for federal student loans in default. The Mountain West News Bureau's Daniel Spalding has more.
The Department of Education started to send notices to borrowers whose loans have gone unpaid for more than 9 months. Employers can withhold up to 15% of disposable income without a court order. This policy may hit indigenous communities especially hard. Higher education analysts say that about 40% of Native borrowers default on their federal loans, and many carry balances longer after graduation than other groups. Nez Perce tribal member Sienna Rubin, who graduated from the University of Idaho in 2021, says wage garnishment adds another financial burden to Native families already stretched thin.
I feel like student loans obviously come last because are you eating them? Are they feeding you? Are they housing you? Are they doing any of this stuff?
Rubin also says that indigenous alumni often have the additional responsibility of supporting family members. I'm Daniel Spalding.
More than a dozen tribal governments have formed the Alliance of Sovereign Tribes of Southeast Alaska. The new partnership promotes a unified approach to addressing regional tribal concerns while acknowledging each tribe's individual differences. Gloria Burns is the president of the Ketchikan Indian community. She says the new partnership has already improved communication between the region's tribes.
As we communicate, then we're going to partner with each other. And when we partner with each other, then we're creating real movement and change with each other.
Albert Smith is the mayor of the Metlakatla Indian community, the only reservation in Alaska. He says there has not been an established partnership of Southeast Alaska tribes in more than 20 years.
The importance is tribes helping tribes, working together for a common goal of the betterment of our region and indigenous peoples of our region.
Other tribal governments in the alliance include the Craig Tribal Association, the Organized Village of Cake, and the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohonic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. Coming up in a bit, we are going to hear about Russia gloats and prediction market boom. So that'll be coming up in just a moment. I'm Andrew DeZingle here, joined by the franchise, Jen Callen.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning.
On this chilly morning.
However, the warmest...
You made chili. Oh.
No. I should. That's a good idea. I haven't made it yet this winter, have you?
No. I don't like chili.
Oh, really?
I'll eat it, but I don't like... I will never make it for myself.
Huh.
Because I don't want that much chili.
You could freeze it.
I don't want it, though.
Oh.
I'll eat it once, and then I'll be like, that's good for the year.
And then you'll live with the burden of knowing there's chili.
As long as it's loaded with sour cream on top and cheese...
How about Fritos to dip?
Oh, yeah, I'll do that.
A little shredded lettuce?
I guess if I have to. But what were you saying?
Today is chilly. I'm not disputing that, but it's going to get a whole lot chillier.
That's true.
Maybe even cold, downright cold.
Yeah, I would say freezing.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah, I mean, there's a warning around the cold.
So when it's this cold out, Jen, what do you like to do maybe to inside the house to pass the time?
Sit by the fire with a cat on my lap.
Aww.
He's a little heater. And knit.
Yes, you were mentioning you knit scarves. Yeah. What's the current project?
I'm in the middle of a couple socks right now.
Okay. What color?
It's like a multicolored yarn. Not a self-striping. You can get some yarn that is like multicolored, and as you knit it, it makes its own stripes.
Oh, cool.
Very cool. This one's just kind of multi-blue, flecks of brown.
Green?
A little green.
All right.
Yeah. I should have brought it.
But what about like reading a book? You reading a book right now?
I am. I'm reading a Adriana Trigiani book right now.
Okay.
She's an author that's been interviewed on this station many times. And then also was at book club, KBXU book club last night, and I'm going to get next month's book on audio so I can listen while I still knit.
Oh, so you're one of those people.
I guess. When I got a knitting deadline, these socks were supposed to be a Christmas gift. So I'm a little...
Interesting.
I could fib and say they're for Christmas 2026, but...
Smart.
They were not. So
what
I got
about
a
birthday? You got a birthday coming up then for them?
Well, I could, yeah. Yeah, she's got a birthday in March.
Oh, so. Well, March. I guess you could still get warmer socks, though.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not out of it by March. That's wishful thinking. What about you? You're just overtime on the movies, I suppose, when it gets cold.
Movies, music, books. I've been doing it all. I did some painting on Monday.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I made a frog painting. I'm pretty happy about it.
What's the frog doing?
It's a bunch of frogs at a concert.
Oh, nice. Do they have concert t-shirts on?
No, I thought about that, but that was like, that's too much work.
That's a lot of detail to do a frog shirt.
Maybe me 5 years ago would have done that, but not me yesterday or Monday.
You're slowing down.
But finished The Sound and the Fury, the William Faulkner book.
Oh, you did. How was it?
It was good, but it's just like, I'm willing to admit I'm not smart enough to like, have completely followed all that's happened, but definitely the second half of the book is much easier to follow than the first half.
That's interesting. I have started and stopped that book probably 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, the first half of it is very hard to, I had to read like Wikipedia of like, okay, who's,
yeah,
who,
right, that
which
is,
I can't imagine reading that book when it came out and just having no way to like find out what is going on.
That is one book I wish I would have been assigned at some point in my life so that it could have been part of a class.
Oh, yeah, like a discussion about what's going on all the time.
Yeah, because, I know that it's an important book and I want to read it, but it's a steep climb.
Well, now I've read 2 Faulkner books, this one, As I Lay Dying, and I like As I Lay Dying better.
Yeah, I read that as well and I enjoyed that. But so should I try it again?
Sure, why not? And then read Wikipedia for what you need to know about who's who.
Or I could ask you.
Yeah, I'll tell you who's who.
Yeah. Did you have to do a little chart?
No.
A little cheat sheet?
No, I really should when I start reading nonfiction books of stuff that like, oh, that'd be good to know later type stuff.
I jot things down and then I just have stacks of like...
Are you talking like sticky notes or?
No, like little journals or a little notebook or, and then I think, okay, I'm going to put it all in this one spot. And then I've got several of those notebooks.
Mm-hmm.
Not organized. I don't know if it's worth
it. So you find them one day and like.
Yeah, and then I'm like, oh, that's right. I started that. That is interesting.
Who is Jason from Sound and the Fury?
Not a memorable character?
No, he's a very memorable character.
Okay. So I would
he's
not.
He's not a good guy, though, so don't get too attached to him.
Okay. That's a good heads up.
That was just the first name I could think of for The Sound of the Fury. Now I can think of more. Quentin, Caddy.
Okay.
Benji.
When was that book written? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh, I have no idea.
I'll have to look.
So, what about, like, cozying up the fire?
Mm-hmm.
What about food? What's the food situation when it's cold like this?
Soup.
Are you in soup mode?
Yeah, soup. And what else? I haven't been cooking much lately.
Me neither, and that's a problem.
I know.
But you said you're going to make chili soon, right?
Well, not if you're not interested in it.
Oh, you were going to bring chili here. Wow.
Why am I going to go through all that work and not have you eat it?
Even though I told you, like, I'm not even that interested in chili, but...
No, I suppose we should probably make one batch. You got to make a batch of chili if you live here in the winter once.
How long does it last?
You know, that's funny because it does always last longer than everybody wants it to. Like, oh, really? In fact, I think we have some odds and ends still in the freezer. I could probably find little freezer bits and combine them all and we could clean them all up.
All right. Well, let us know what you're doing at home. What are you cooking? What are you doing to stay warm these next few days? Text us at 218-326-1234. Should Jen Kellen read The Sound and the Fury?
Yeah.
It's time.
Right. Does anyone have any insight on that book they can share with Andrew?
Yeah. Post-read? I would love to talk about it.
That'd be interesting to hear.
Support comes from Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with 4 galleries, art classes for adults and children, and a retail art gallery. Shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. More at watermarkartcenter.org.
We also receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure, with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com.
And we receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. Now it's time for Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
Jaime Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump's demand for U.S. control of the Danish territory of Greenland continues to antagonize American allies, which really has been a gift to U.S. geopolitical foes, perhaps maybe no more so than Russia. Joining us with a view from there is NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. So considering Trump has mentioned national security concerns surrounding Russia as a reason for his interest in Greenland, Charles, how have they been reacting to this there?
Well, you know, some of the loudest voices, and by that I mean nationalists and propagandists, you know, they've had a field day with this, really taunting Europe over how it was always so worried about threats from Moscow, when in fact the real threat was from Washington. That said, the Kremlin's been more subdued. Here's spokesman Dmitry Peskov on a phone call with reporters earlier this week. So here Peskov says it's not really up to him to judge whether Trump's attempt to seize Greenland is good, bad, or even legal. But Peskov added that he couldn't help but agree with experts who felt that in doing so, Trump would surely go down in history.
Well, okay, so doesn't that kind of sound like they're egging Trump on?
It sure does, and you can understand why. Yeah. You know, Russia has long seen NATO as its primary national security threat, so much so that among its reasons the Kremlin uses to justify the invasion of Ukraine is, of course, Ukraine's desire to join the alliance. And yet now what we have are NATO members fighting among themselves, even voicing concerns it could be the end of NATO itself, all for reasons not of Russia's making. Meanwhile, Trump's demand for Greenland has exposed this, you know, if you can, why can't we dynamic that undermines Western criticism of Russia's actions in Ukraine. That was certainly on display yesterday at a press conference I attended in Moscow, where Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov drew parallels between the U.S. and Russia's need to annex territory. Here's Lavrov in translation.
Как сказал президент Трамп, эта территория важна для безопасности Соединенных Штатов.
As President Trump has said, this territory is important for the security of the United States. Well, Crimea is no less important for the security of the Russian Federation than Greenland is for the U.S.
Now, Lavrov, of course, is referring to Russia's annexation of Crimea from Ukraine in 2014, a move that was denounced by most of the international community, including the U.S., as illegal. I should add, Lavrov also denied Trump's claims that Russia, or for that matter China, poses a threat to Greenland, part of Trump's justification for wanting the territory. But Lavrov's larger message was, if the transatlantic alliance wants to tear itself apart, have at it. You know, we won't stand in your way.
Wow. Now, you know, Charles, it's funny, I'm struck by the fact that just 2 weeks ago we were talking about Russian foreign policy setbacks with the U.S. attack on Venezuela, threats against Iran, both Kremlin allies.
Yeah, you know, and the takeaway was Russia was an unreliable partner. It couldn't protect its friends. The headlines over Trump and Greenland take some of the sting out of that. But for all the current Russian gloating, there are fears in Moscow that however this Greenland crisis ends, a long-term U.S. military presence in the Arctic is coming, perhaps including Trump's proposal for a nuclear Golden Dome umbrella that Russia's been concerned about, says Hannah Notte, a Eurasia program director at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies.
It's just that the political utility of these threats currently, I think, outweighs these longer-term strategic concerns.
Now, a Note cautions that what this ultimately means for Russian power or Ukraine or NATO's future isn't yet clear. It really depends on President Trump and how he handles the days and weeks ahead.
All right, it's NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Prediction markets are booming. The Trump administration has cleared the way for services that take bets on sports, government policy, world events, and even elections. NPR's Bobby Allen talked to people who quit their jobs to do it full time.
Most days, 25-year-old Logan Suddeth can be found lounging in his bed in his Atlanta apartment, staring at Polymarket and Kalshi. The former financial analyst started placing bets on the two big prediction market sites for things like who will be Time Magazine's Person of the Year and will President Trump say drill, baby, drill at a press conference. Suddeth's wins were piling up just as his entry-level job at a small finance firm was paying him
like $75,000.
And you're making more than that annually on Kalshi.
Yeah, like last month I made like $100,000.
$75,000 a year versus $100,000 a month. The math was clear. So he quit his job and joined millions of other traders who log on to place billions of dollars of weekly trades on prediction market apps. Critics say this is simply tech-powered gambling. But backers argue the wisdom of the crowd can forecast the future better than polls and the media. Naturally, betting on the news often means streaming events with President Trump and making high-dollar wagers of his unpredictable choice of words.
I'm not a fan of Trump, though I do spend most of my day listening to him and tracking what he's doing. I guess Trump winning was definitely beneficial for me, even though I didn't vote for him.
The Biden administration tried to rein in prediction market trading, but Trump's regulators are clearing the way for these companies to thrive. Now, is all of this legal? The short answer is yes, but it's highly controversial. It's regulated as a futures contract, not as gambling. Here's Kristen Johnson, a former commissioner with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which oversees prediction markets.
The markets are not only not new, they're pretty ancient. If we kind of reflect back in terms of the notion that you could have a contract that predicts the outcome of a particular event.
In the 1880s, people hedged price swings in things like wheat, corn, gold, and silver. Today, Kalshi and Polymarket are letting people put money down on who will win elections. Johnson fears this could lead to a type of election meddling, where money from overseas or deep-pocketed donors could try to influence how voters see a candidate's odds of winning. Johnson says this could put the CFTC in the position of being an election cop without ever having a debate in Washington about it.
A public dialogue with people who will be impacted, citizens in the country and the businesses that want to do this, about what the implications of permitting those kinds of contracts might be.
In Miami, Evan Semin agrees election betting can invite insiders who want to profit or sway opinions. He also quit his finance job to bet on Kalshi and Polymarket full time. He even set up a dedicated server to run statistical models of his bets. Does he think the companies are doing enough to root out insider trading?
Excuse my French, but no.
Zemet says many traders place bets under pseudonyms, so it's hard to prove insider trading on things like tech news, where he's often betting.
There are certain wallets that, you know, miraculously have every single Google and like OpenAI release date nailed perfectly. And it's like, all right, just don't fade those people.
He's talking about crypto wallets, which is how most people trade on Polymarket. And don't fade those people means just don't bet against them. These prediction market traders have developed their own lingo for talking to each other on online forums like Reddit and Discord.
there's always going to be somebody that has more information than you, unless you're the insider.
Cauchy and Polymarket both say they prohibit and monitor for market manipulation, but beefed up federal rules aren't expected anytime soon. The president's son, Donald Trump Jr., advises both companies, and the president's Truth Social platform wants to start its own prediction market. The five-member CFTC doesn't appear ready to regulate, since right now it only has one commissioner. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Morning Edition here on Wednesday Morning Show here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Jen Kellen. And looking at the National Day calendar, I'm going to throw out some things at you.
Ooh, I haven't looked yet.
Yeah.
Sometimes I peek, but I have not looked.
First of all, it's National Hugging Day.
Oh, that's
nice. Sweet.
That's a good thing to do in the cold.
Oh, yeah, to stay warm, too.
Yeah.
And then it's also Squirrel Appreciation Day.
Are you kidding me?
Where do you stand on squirrels?
Oh my gosh. What? How?
Yeah, what do they do for what? Us?
Why?
I guess they like transfer acorns to like plant trees.
They do. I know. They're a valuable part
of the
ecosystem.
You can't say one nice thing about a squirrel, Jen? Wow.
They're a valuable part of the ecosystem. I acknowledge that. But who thought, you know what? You know what we're missing in this world?
Squirrel appreciation?
Yeah. Why? How? I want to know the origins of.
You got to have a day for something.
Well, we had hugging already had a day.
We'll wait till you hear this next one.
Okay.
So move over, squirrels. It's National Granola Bar Day.
Hey, love a granola bar.
Yeah, you do. You have one right there.
I got one right here.
Did you know that it was National Granola Bar Day?
No, every day is Granola Bar Day for me. Big fan. I remember way back in 19 clickety clack. I feel like I remember when granola bars were invented.
Really?
Well, it was there were the crunchy Nature Valley ones, and I was like in kindergarten or first grade, and somebody at the lunch table had them, and I was like,
Do you remember what flavor they had?
It's the green wrapper.
Okay, so that's like
honey. Yeah, honey and oat, maybe.
And so I'm a blueberry guy.
Peanut butter?
I'll eat a peanut butter one.
I went home and begged to get granola bars. It was so appealing to me.
Was the kid like, yeah, no big deal. I do have a granola bar.
Pretty much.
They just invented it.
Yeah, he was selling it pretty hard. His dad probably worked at Nature Valley.
Oh.
I don't know. Is that even the right name?
Nature Valley,
okay.
I think.
I was sounding wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, because it's Hidden Valley for ranch, right?
Yes, right, yeah. Right. Too many ranches. I would be curious.
Too many valleys.
Do you like a granola bar?
Yeah, I like a granola bar.
Do you?
Like I said, I would like the fruitier kind. I don't really care for honey.
Fruit and nut?
Yeah.
Chewy or crunchy?
I'd go for either.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The crunchy are so messy.
That's my problem with granola bars is they get crumbly.
I bet a squirrel likes a granola bar.
So let us know what you're doing today. Do you appreciate the squirrels, unlike some people on the air right now? Text us at 218-326-1234. And while we're waiting for you, we're going to hear a tune from Carson McCone. This song is called Winter Breaking.
Shall we meet at last? Deliberate.